Hello, everyone. Welcome. Ethan Tucker, I'm here stepping in for Rav Michael Rosenberg, and really happy to be with you here doing this piece of the learning that you've been doing together. And Rav Michael sends his regrets for not being able to be here, but I think you all know we have both worked on this project for a long time together, so hopefully we'll be able to pull it all together. Great. We're looking at the end of the material that is focused on the question of minyan. And so we're going to pick up from where you were, which my understanding is that the last thing that people saw was the levush. Okay, so we were on page 6 of this, if you'd like to follow along on your own. So just as a review, there are two main conceptions of how to understand what it means when we emerge with a tradition that minyan is gendered. And those two traditions writ large were those of Rabbeinu Tam and that of the Levush. You can say minyan is gendered, like Shulchan Aruch, it must be Asara Zicharim. But the question remains, what does that mean? What is the basis behind that? Broadly speaking, Rabbeinu Tam laid out a theory, which I gather you have gone through, which essentially said that, well, in principle, anyone who is a member of the Jewish people and or obligated in mitzvot in some sense is eligible for minyan. In theory, you could make up a minyan of 10 minors, according to Rabbeinu Tam, but there are guardrails on the question of dignity, yikara d'shmaya, the honor of heaven, that prevents us from enacting that all the way. And this was Rabbeinu Tam's way of understanding and explaining the ruling in the Gemara of Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, tisha ba'eved mitzarfim, that 9 and a slave would be able to form a minyan, or 9 and a minor, or a snif might be more than 1 than 10, but you couldn't have a majority minyan of minors, because even though they meet the theoretical criteria for hashra'at shechina, of having a sense of the presence of heaven having come down in that space, it doesn't sort of, the way I like to translate yikara d'shmaya, it doesn't pass the straight-faced test of being a serious gathering. And that's one way of even understanding why you wouldn't even count a minor as a tenth, or why a minyan would have to be entirely male. In the Rabbeinu Tam model, it would be about questions of dignity, honor, what is taken seriously on a social level. The Levush offers a different framing, and that is what you got to last time, and we'll just pick up from there. I've put this up on the screen. Because they are not obligated in mitzvot, these classically more marginal characters of the slave, the woman, and the minor do not count. Now, if you know, and you've been following in this series of shiurim, you know how rabbinic literature talks about this. Well, it's not that those characters aren't obligated in mitzvot. It's that they don't have a maximal obligation in mitzvot. And because they don't have a maximal obligation in mitzvot, they can't represent the community in microcosm, even as a tenth. You see, the Levush brings as an alternative, there are some who allow a minor to count as a tenth. But it's clear his initial presentation of this is that there is no such exception, and it's just a lack of obligation in mitzvot, of maximal obligation in mitzvot, that prevents you from being counted in this way. So I want to emphasize, this is the moment where we're going to split to kind of be clear on what does it take? And this is often the question that I think it's important to ask, and you may have been asking it throughout. There's less interesting often is the question of who allows this or who forbids that. The more interesting question is often, given that someone said X, what would you have to say to get them on board with a certain conclusion? And here, that's the most useful way of understanding the distinction between Rabbeinu Tam on the one hand and the Levush on the other hand. To get Rabbeinu Tam on board with a gender blind minyan, you would have to claim, all you would have to claim, what you would have to claim, is that the concerns of honor, honor of heaven, that he highlights as the gatekeeper for whether you can count in practice if you're otherwise a Jew or embedded in the covenant in some way, you have to claim that that no longer has a gendered application in the contemporary world. You do not, according to Rabbeinu Tam, need to make contemporary Jewish women obligated in things that they were not obligated in the classical rabbinic eye. You just need to claim that those people who are theoretically candidates for counting in a minyan, according to Rabbeinu Tam, are also practical candidates for counting in a minyan, because the gatekeeper of Yakara Deshmaya, of the honor of heaven, no longer applies or has been rethought of. We'll see that in a moment. Whereas according to the Levush, what you would have to say to create a gender-blind minyan is to claim that in the contemporary world, maximal obligation in mitzvot is itself gender-blind. It's a different claim. It's potentially a more robust claim that we can always argue what's the more radical or conservative type of interpretation on this or that issue. But those are two very different things. All right, so I want to make sure that's clear. The branching out from Rabbeinu Tam and the Levush is not just how do they think of minyan, but what are the ramifications for how that gets translated to gender. And we're going to move forward and see some of the reevaluation of the question of minyan through each of these lenses. So one of the first and most important sources in this regard is the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, citing the view of Rav Simcha of Speyer from the early Middle Ages, well, high Middle Ages in Ashkenaz, in Germany. So he writes as follows. It's written in the Mordechai, in the name of Rabbeinu Simcha, that a slave and a woman may be included for tefillah and for the grace after meals in the tent. And clearly, this is according to the explanation of Rabbeinu Tam, who ruled like Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi that one slave may be included. And Rabbeinu Simcha opined that this is also the law for a woman. For in every situation, in halakha context, a woman's status is equal to that of a slave. Now, that last line obviously sort of burns on the ears. It's not a statement we would say today in polite company, and perhaps bears interrogation in its original context as well. But just so we're clear what it's saying, the idea is that women, Jewish women, and men who basically come to be under the domain, non-Jewish men who become under the domain of Jews in the context of servitude, I think you've encountered this already, share a basic level of obligation in all kinds of mitzvot, in particular in the context of time-bound mitzvot, classically things like lulav, sukkah, shofar, and a number of other things. So the main thing that we're interested in here is that there is a ruling by Rabbeinu Simcha, which seems to count at least one woman in a minyan. It's not clear if it's limited to one woman alone, though that is how most sources take it to be. We will assume that's what it means for our purposes, the more conservative reading. Rabbeinu Simcha would count a woman as the tenth. And the question is why? And the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, several hundreds of years later, says the reason for that is he's just playing out the theory of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, you will recall when you learned him, never actually talked about gender at all. He talked about kids, he talked about slaves, but he laid out a theory which, if applied with the lens of gender, would lead to a theoretically gender-equal conception of minyan. And then there's the restriction of Yakara Deshamaya, which prevents us from acting on it. The Beit Yosef is saying all Rabbeinu Simcha did here was looked at Rabbeinu Tam, counted a kid as a tenth, counted a slave as a tenth, realized there's no reason not to extend that to the category of gender as well. And based on that, practically, and in other cases it says, Rabbeinu Simcha would actually act on this. It wasn't just theoretical. counted a woman, again, at least as a tenth, to the minyan. So that's the first sense we see of someone going with Rabbeinu Tam's reasoning and doing some application to the area of gender that brings women into minyan. Again, perhaps only as the tenth in practice, but in theory using Rabbeinu Tam. Then the Beit Yosef continues. But since Rabbeinu Tam himself did not want to do such a thing with respect to counting a minor and a minyan, we have those traditions that say he thought that was theoretically okay, but he didn't actually do it. Who can be lenient regarding it? And thus the world has the custom not to include a woman at all. So the Beit Yosef sitting in the 16th century, his assessment is, I found this view that will count a woman as a tenth. But since it's based on a theoretical model that even the author of that theoretical model was not willing to put into practice, I don't really see how we can then get into some kind of extension in that regard. And that indeed is the practice that he reports, that there is no practice of counting a woman even as a tenth in the context of this halacha. Okay, so not much moves there. And therefore, it's not surprising that in the Shulchan Aruch, you get this ruling when they're talking about Kaddish is coming up and how many people do you need there? Ein omrim oto bepachot me'asara zicharim b'nei chorin gilim shevir shtei sarot. You need, among all the other requirements here, asara zecharim, 10 males, right? And that emerges from the Beit Yosef statement, right? Shulchan Aruch and Beit Yosef, same author, his statement in the Beit Yosef that this is not a live position of Rabbeinu Simcha, and therefore, practically, we're not going to follow it. As we said, there's a lot at stake, actually, if Rabbeinu Tam's theory of minyan is actually what's driving this, but just in practice, we're not playing it out. Well, then we might revisit it in other contexts where we will say, well, here, the concerns of honor and other things that you saw in that model don't apply. But for now, the Shulchan Aruch has shut that down. The Bach here, I just, you know, want you to pay attention to, we won't read it inside, is a good example of the simplicity of the Beit Yosef statement that no one follows Rabbeinu Simcha, not actually true and so simple. The Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis here in 16th century Poland, actually says that he rules. He says, you do count a woman as the tenth towards Birkat HaMazon, towards the Zimun Bashem, the use of God's name and the invitation to grace. So some degree of slippage there as to whether that description of reality is actually right. But now let's get to the interesting sources that actually begin to play with Rabbeinu Tam's model and start to explore some different possibilities. Okay, so the Moruk Tziyah, here we are with Rav Yaakov Emden. So we're a year later, we're in the 18th century, and we have the following reflection that he offers. It's written, he says, in the Mordechai, that a slave and a woman can count towards the 10 required for the Amidah and Birkat HaMazon. That's the view we just saw quoted in the Beit Yosef. And instead of dismissing this the way the Beit Yosef did, the Moruk Tziyah says the following. Rabbeinu Simcha's position clearly has solid Kabbalistic as well as halachic grounding, because a woman clearly counts towards the quorum of 10 and towards the quorum of 7. Therefore, Chazal explicitly said that a woman counts towards the 7 who read from the Torah, but they nonetheless said that she may not read in public because of the honor of the community. And that is also the problem with counting women towards the quorum of 10. It is clear, it is clearly the law that the only obstacle towards counting her is the issue of honor. We'll come to the second half of that sentence in a moment, but let's just understand this analysis of the Moruk Tziyah. So the idea here is Rabbi Yaakov Emden is picking up on Rabbeinu Tam and his use here and noting that, well, Rabbeinu Simcha is basically saying women in principle belong as candidates for minyan. And when he says there's solid Kabbalistic as well as halachic grounding, he's referring to the fact that in Kabbalistic thought, the 10 sefirot, or emanations of God, are a group of 10, And they are sometimes also grouped in a subgrouping of seven. And without getting into all the details here, he says, Hamevin Yavin, one who understands, understands. And I don't claim to be a Kabbalistic expert by any stretch. But in terms of what he's talking about here, one of the manifestations of God is Malchut, which is understood to be a manifestation of the Shekhinah, feminine aspect of the Godhead, which means that in the group of 10 aspects of God and in the group of 7 aspects of God, which Malchut is also included in, there is femininity. And therefore, to the extent that the gendered aspects of God have anything to say about the minion of 10, which is meant in a certain way to map onto the various emanations of God to which, like, each person in the minion is imagined to correspond, well, then, if there's femininity in the Godhead, there ought to be able to be femininity in the composition of the people below. That's what's cryptically alluded at here. And therefore, he says, that explains to you why, when you get to Torah reading, which you saw in greater depth in earlier sessions, we see, in principle, women just count towards the 7 aliyot. Hakol olim l'minyan shiva, afilu isha. Why has there been a history of Torah reading being gendered? Mipnei kvod hatzibur, because of the honor of the community. And now claims, in other words, so what does that mean? The model of Torah reading is women theoretically can read all the aliyot. However, because of issues of honor, they can't participate in practice, right? At least in the classical sources. You went through all the things you might say to change that. But then Rav Emden wants to say, well, that's the same issue with a minion of 10. Once a minion of 10 is understood to be, you know, in the Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Simcha, reinforced by the Kabbalah dynamic, so theoretically, 10 women make up a minyan. What is the block here as well? The block here is honor. Bevadai sheken halacha she'en metzarfin otam mipnei hakavod bilvad. The only halachic obstacle to that is a question of honor. Now, he says, nonetheless, now that all the poskim agree that that's not allowed, you can't really do anything about it, even though, and here you see his sort of one of his translations of kavod, we might have said, according to what I've written, that one could be more lenient in counting her towards the 10 than with Torah reading, because that is only possible with her truly being in one place with the community, which is not the case with 10, where a woman could stand by the side or in an adjoining room such that she could join without impinging on the community's honor. So this is highlighting, we haven't actually really taken apart, what is the concern or the question of honor? How does it manifest? The more Tziayir seems to imagine when you have a mixed environment of men and women, there is something that is dishonorable. Not clear if he means that to include some sense of sexual impropriety or the mingling of the sexes itself, or whether it means something more like you're confronting in a real way that you don't have a sufficient number of men to add up to the quorum, and to the extent that doesn't fit with social standards of seriousness, it's downgrading the whole experience. Whereas if you had some separation, people are on the side, you don't have the same sense of that. Whatever it is, you see him playing towards a theoretical dropping of the kavod concern. Nonetheless, one shouldn't depart from the decision of the Beit Yosef that widespread custom is not to count her at all. Okay? So what's important about this Moruktsia? Again, not a source offering practical encouragement on a mixed gender minyan, but a source that is highlighting, here's what it looks like to be in the Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Simcha camp. The only thing you're addressing is a question of kavod. He is not rejiggering who's obligated in which mitzvot. He's not making broader claims about whether the categories of male and female versus mitzvot no longer exist in the same way. It's just a question of what are the kavod issues as received in a different context. Okay, so the question come up here, how's the Moruk Tzion dialogue with the Rambam, Rav Sadia Gaon? I would say to you, Rambam, Rav Sadia Gaon are going to fit much well. But I'll give you two answers. One, the Rambam and Rav Sadia Gaon don't tell you anything. All they tell you is you have to have nails. But we don't know if that you have to have nails is because ontologically females are unfit for that role, or whether that's a shorthand for there's an issue of kavod, which is the implicit thing that they're not stating, right? That's one way of reading them. The other way of reading them is their simple, uncomplicated statement in that regard reveals Levush-like thinking of no. As long as someone is not in the category of full obligation, we don't know. This, it's a very helpful question because part of what we're doing now is actually confronting that when a source comes along and says, you need men, even if it says it simply, you don't know from that alone why that's the case, right? And that's where actually this interrogation means they could actually mean any of those things, and therefore they are not dispositive for the discussion. All we can do is go to the people who play out the different possibilities. So thanks for clarifying that, because it's how it both does and doesn't tie in to lots of things that you've seen before. Okay, so let's go on here. A few other things, okay, sharing again here. And the Orach LaTzadik is a pretty wild source here, which we'll see that plays out the same dynamic of taking seriously Rabbeinu Tam's model and imagining how it plays out. The Orach LaTzadik is dealing with the question of counting an androgynous in a minyan. Someone who, if you look at, you know, a lot of earlier translations of sources like this, will be referred to as a hermaphrodite. There are more, you know, sort of, if you're not using technical language, and that term in particular has become a passé, a not really accepted term to use more broadly. You'll talk about someone with ambiguous gender characteristics, sex characteristics. Mostly, like just descriptively, it's someone who basically in rabbinic sources is described as having both manifestations, sexual, you know, body manifestations, both of male and female characteristics. And the question that's being addressed here is whether an androgynous, someone with such a body, counts in a minyan against the backdrop of an assumption that men count in a minyan and women don't. So this becomes an interesting sort of border case for probing what is it that we're thinking about or talking about. And essentially, the larger context here of the Orach LaTzadik, this is an anonymous posek. It's brought in the collection of Orach LaTzadik, which is Rav Avram Chaim Rodriguez. But this is a sage, we don't know who it is. He makes this argument and he says, well, look at Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam said, if you're obligated in mitzvot and you're part of the Jewish people, well, then you count in the minyan. And so therefore, an androgynous is part of the Jewish people and is obligated in mitzvot. And so therefore, an androgynous should count in a minyan. Obviously, the word androgynous, if you didn't catch it yet and you're not familiar with it, is just based on the Greek androgyne, okay? So then he addresses the following objection. You might object to my argument that an androgynous should count in a minyan, because according to my logic, we'd have to count a woman towards the quorum of 10. Because she also is a member of the covenant, just like a slave, and yet we explicitly hold that a woman does not count. How can you make this argument if it's going to lead you to the reductio ad absurdum of a gender-blind minyan, which we know is not right? And then he gives the following answer. I would respond that, in fact, a woman should by all rights count. And the Mordechai wrote in the name of Rabbeinu Simcha, cited in Beit Yosef, that a woman counts towards the 10 needed for tefillah. And actually, the way this Chacham seems to have read that case is that, in theory, following Rabbeinu Tam and Rabbeinu Simcha, women should count as equals in the minyan because they fit the criteria. But we may not actually count her because of the honor of the community. Here, too, we see the direct translation that the Moruk Tziah suggested, now asserted by this Chacham. The issue is only Kvod HaTzibur. And this seems to be the point of Beit Yosef when he writes in reaction to Rabbeinu Simcha that the custom everywhere is not to count a woman at all. This is merely a custom. And if it is the case that a woman can clearly count, were it not for the problem of quota tzibur, all the more in our case where that concern does not exist. So there's an assumption here, we're not going to interrogate it, it's not really clear, that there are real issues of kavod, of honor, dignity, of counting a woman towards the minyan in ways that don't apply to the androgynous. It may be the androgynous is assumed to be passing as male, or even if his sex is ambiguous, even the pronoun his is difficult to use in this context, right? But even if that person's sex is ambiguous, that nonetheless their gender presents as more male. There may be any number of contexts here, but one way or the other, this text is important for us because it shows a posek saying, yeah, I know the Shulchan Aruch says you can't do it. He even says, I wouldn't do it either. But the reason I wouldn't do it is just because of minhag and kavod. Essentially, this is an issue of convention, not an issue of deep ontological status. Okay? And we won't read the Toldot Yaakov here. This is an amazing sort of source, though, that takes you through a thought experiment of, I don't know, should women count for a man? Is there any evidence in the Talmud? And from the fact that he says, maybe there is evidence, maybe there's not, and he defeats all the potential proofs from the Talmud that might disqualify women counting, you get actually a very clear picture from this text that there is no real Talmudic evidence on the question, at least dispositive Talmudic evidence. The closest he ends up with the statement is, it may be Zila Bahem Milta Sarif Isha, that there's something shameful that was inappropriate that they assumed was not appropriate in terms of counting women towards the minyan. But truth be told, you can't get to more than social convention or social discomfort around it. And again, if you want to understand these sources as saying something, you know, substantive on a sociological level, it's saying something like, people just don't take that gender arrangement of a group seriously as something where, as it were, you know, heads of household are present, or that this is a group with significant gravity such that we can imagine moving to this ritual that requires a minyan. I'll show you the last voice on this, which grows out of these sources and this approach. This is the Ura Shachar, who was a Polish rabbi in the 19th century. And he says the following. In the Beit Yosef, he cites the opinion of Rashi. It's made not clear, is it Rashi, is it Rabbeinu Simcha? It's been spelled out here in the Hebrew as Rabbeinu Simcha, but originally it's written as Reish Shin Yud. But let's just say, he cites the opinion that a woman or slave can be included in the ten. Sorry. And the Beit Yosef wrote that this is according to the explanation of Rabbeinu Tam. Okay? So far, so good. Further notes and says in Sanhedrin, at the end of the Perek, the chapter Ben Sorer, the eighth chapter, we ask regarding the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, of martyrdom. What if there's nine Jews and one non-Jew? What is the law? So there's a context there that assumes that there are certain contexts where martyrdom, that is to say, giving up your life rather than violating a mitzvah, only kicks in when you are in the presence of Bnei Yisrael, in the presence of a public group of Jews. A group of 10. Parhesia, a public group, includes 10 Jews. But the Gemara asked, what if I have 9 Jews and 1 non-Jew? Is that enough of a Jewish group to trigger this higher standard of martyrdom? And he says, the fact that the Gemara asks about a non-Jew as the border case, that implies that a woman or slave certainly are included. And not only this, but it also implies that v'nikdashti betoch b'nei Yisrael, which is the verse invoked to require a quorum for martyrdom, implies that that verse, and I will be sanctified, applies amidst 10 women. Because if when we're interrogating the mitzvah of martyrdom, which requires a minyan, our border case is asking about non-Jews, obviously women are in, and therefore, in theory, any time you invoke that verse, the Nikdashti B'toch B'nei Yisrael, like when you're talking about the need to do Kaddish or to repeat the Amida, there's nothing gendered about that. And therefore, he says, and it's possible that the reason a woman is not included for the purposes of tefillah, that is to say, that conventional halakha, which we all know from the Shulchan Aruch, is only because it is not the way of the world. Lav orach ara, which is another way of saying a convention, not the way things have been done. If you want the Yiddish translation, espas nisht. This is not something you do, but not because there's some ontological element here that is really actually gendered. Okay? So that gives you a little bit of a flavor of the Rabbeinu Tam wing of this picture. If you've been following along all along and you remember back to the Torah reading piece where you had the Beit Yosef versus the Bach on Kvod HaTzibur and questions of whether this was like an objective standard or something that was more variable, you got into sort of reevaluating, like, oh, what if I don't have Kvod HaTzibur? What if it's a situation where there's like a matriarch of the family, everyone who's descendant, or you're in a society where things have shifted in that regard, maybe Kvod HaTzibur doesn't apply. That's the same dynamic that this school will play out. And if you're in this school, the way you get to the gender-blind minyan, again, is by asserting, actually, the Kavod issues have switched. What's the most robust version of that here? It would be, like, on some level, the most conservative, small-c way of making this claim is, I take very seriously the fact that there are these sources that say that gender needs to track with minyan based on concerns of honor. What I'm telling you is I experience quora that exclude women in the contemporary environment to be extremely dishonoring, not just to the women who would be excluded, but to the seriousness of the proceedings. Meaning if I look around my society and I say, where do I see a quorum of all men where women are not allowed that I take seriously? It's not the Supreme Court. I mean, is it the NFL? Like, what are the contexts where that would be taken seriously? And one can imagine, therefore, making a quite conservative argument, which is to say, yes, specifically because I'm trying to safeguard the honor of minyan, actually what's required is a gender-blind manifestation. That would be a way of reading Rabbeinu Tam. That will not on its own get you to bringing the Levush on board, where you have to make more fundamental assertions about obligations, like who's obligated today in a lulav, in a shofar, and does that have gendered consequences in the way that it was always assumed to in the past. So a lot of the subsequent sources here, Orach Latzadik number 3 being one example, there are many other sources of which this Orach Latzadik is an example, where you will see people rejecting concerns of honor. And what I want to suggest to you, what Rav Michal and I in general basically want to argue, is that whenever you see a source like this that is completely rejecting any playing out of honor concerns, they're really implicitly taking the Levush's side. So whereas, Miranda, going back to your question, I don't know exactly what the Rambam thought when he just said, oh, you need to have men, at least in the one case where he says that. Here, when someone explicitly rejects the Rabbeinu Tam frame, I am able to assert, I think much more responsibly, oh, this person's going with the Levush. Let's just see his argument here against that anonymous sage. Do you mean to say that because one is obligated to pray the Amidah on account of its being a personal request for mercy, they're obligated to pray with a minyan of 10, there's other considerations, then you tried, here's the key part for our purposes, then you tried without success to cite proof from the Beit Yosef citation of the Mordechai that those who permit counting a minor do so because the Shechinah dwells in any group of 10. Why would we exclude the androgyne, who is also of holy stock? That was the argument. Everything you say is surprising. This is Rav Avraham Chaim Rodriguez. You yourself admit without shame that your proofs are drawn from rejected positions regarding minors and women, meaning you're relying on Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. You're relying on Rabbeinu Tam, We don't follow those people. If so, are you coming to teach me the reasons for Beit Shammai's opinion? Those reasons have no authority, given that we do not follow their practical implementation. According to your logic, we should count women towards the quorum of 10 for tefillah, whether one or many, based on the fact that they are obligated to pray the Amidah and are of holy stock, and towards the quorum needed for every davar shebikdusha. Chei nafshi shemitvoshesh ani v'nichlam nashiv al dvarim eilu. By my life, I'm ashamed and embarrassed even to have to respond to such an argument. Okay, now that's getting a little heated under the collar. I think it's always useful to analyze when a posek gets heated under the collar, why, right? Why does that happen? So there's a few things here, right? And then we'll get to how the other arguer would have responded, right? So the first claim here is that you, Orach Latzadik number two, are the lenient view. You are relying on Rabbeinu Tam's model, and Rav Rodriguez here in Orach Latzadik 3 is saying, I reject that model. I assume when the Beit Yosef didn't follow that position practically, didn't count a woman as a tenth, he was not just rejecting Rabbeinu Simcha's practical guidance. He was rejecting the whole model on which that guidance was based, namely Rabbeinu Tam. And therefore, that model is dead. Now, what's the alternative model? The alternative model is one in which I don't care if you're obligated in the Amidah, part one of this series. I think implicitly, if you are not obligated in all the mitzvot in a maximal way, you don't count for the minyan. That is to say, this seems to be the Levush branch, and you're seeing the honor issues are not enough. What do we also see? And this goes to Rina, your comment. Are we talking about the 10th person versus a number of people? So this goes back to Rabbeinu Simcha's position practically was ruling that you could count a woman as the 10th. That's at least how it's received. But the underlying theoretical structure for justifying that was, theoretically, gender has nothing to do with minyan. It's just for Rabbeinu Simcha, he was willing to tolerate the issue of that there was no, right, let me say it better this way. Given that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi in the Talmud allowed counting a slave as a tenth, Rabbeinu Simcha felt comfortable saying, well, whatever honor issues there are obviously don't extend to the tenth slot for women, and therefore I will count a woman as a tenth. But the Orach Latzadik number two, the anonymous posek, indeed says, yeah, but in theory, if you eliminated the honor issues, you would count women as equals to all 10 slots. And Rav Rodriguez here in Orach Latzadik number three agrees with that, meaning he disagrees with the policy, but he agrees that that's what the other view is saying, right? According to your logic, we should count women towards the quorum of 10, whether one or many. Now, that's actually a practical misrepresentation of the earlier lenient view, because the earlier lenient view about an androgyne did not actually permit counting women as equals in the minyan. It just said the only problem with not counting women in minyan is an issue of honor. If I determine the honor issue doesn't apply with androgynes, then I account them equally in a minyan. And theoretically, were you to tell me that the honor issue didn't apply to women, which I don't think that particular 18th century sage was imagining, but theoretically, this strict view is right, you would end up with a gender-blind minyan. Now, that's part of what the retort would be, right? In other words, the retort would be, I never said I'm going to count women. The retort would be, I just was claiming that the only issue around gender and minyan is kavod. But what's important is that this other source, and there's others not on the sheet, demonstrate actually a whole other strand that says, indeed, this is not just an issue of kavod. This is an issue of something much more fundamental. And this, as I say, in the discourse of what would you have to say to get various people on board, clarifies for us that to get Rav Rodriguez in Orach Latzadik number three on board, you would have to say something like what Rav Yoel ben Nun says in this passage on page 13. Here is sort of cutting the Gordian knot and asking in a much more fundamental way, hey, do the gendered distinctions around obligation still play out in the contemporary world? I imagine you covered this in an earlier session, at least in a glancing way. When rabbinic sources say that groups of people are exempt from, let's say, hearing the shofar, and it groups women together with slaves and minors, nashim avadim uktanim, are those just totally different groups of people who happen to share the same rule? Or does their juxtaposition indicate that they share some kind of attribute that enables us to be able to compare them? If the latter, well, then maybe actually it's not actually a rule about women at all. It's a rule about a certain socioeconomic status, which might, in the time of Chazal, have had gendered and other manifestations. The latter reading is what Rav Yoel ben Nun argues, saying, Rov hanashim shoyamenu benot chorinen. Most contemporary women should be understood to be independent or liberated. That is to say, having the socioeconomic status that is more analogous to a man of old than to a slave of old. And they do not bear any resemblance to slaves. Shaharei ein reshut acherim aleihem. There is no higher power over them. The rov, the most here, is recognizing that in some contexts this remains aspirational. In all contexts, it may remain somewhat aspirational in terms of women earning, a dollar on the male dollar, etc. But Rav Yoel ben Nun is still making a point here that we live in a completely different society than Chazal on this point. And to the extent that Chazal's halachot on this point, when they juxtapose Nashim and Avadim together in a text, is meant to telegraph to us, hey, you understand this is a socioeconomic halacha, right? Like, if that were to change, it would be different. Well, then you would say the following. Therefore, anyone who cites the ruling of the sages, which are based on the notion that a woman is similar to a slave in all arenas, fails to understand that he's transferring halacha from one reality to another without any basis whatsoever. Our women, Nashim Shalanu, are not only important, as the Rama already said, that's a halacha having to do with reclining at the Seder, super interesting context on its own, but our women are independent, liberated. They are benot chorin. Rav Yoel ben Nun is trying to give halachic language here for what he understands to be the sort of wave of feminism with all its numbers and gender equality that was experienced and advanced in meaningful ways in the 20th century and particularly in the second half thereof. And that there's not just the category which is already played with in medieval times of maybe women in like Christendom at a higher standard than in Islamic lands, and that might have ramifications for certain halachot around the dinner table and family dynamics. This is a whole other level of the class of women are in a different place of independence, serve as cabinet ministers, prime ministers, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, et cetera, et cetera. It is obvious that we are not speaking about the same category of nashim. Pashut lo medivar beoto sug shel nashim. Now, like all assertions like this, you can argue about it, right? And you can say, do I think that's right? Like, do I buy that? But that's what it looks like to make the claim, right? To make the claim that within the discourse of halacha and the branch of the levush, you would get to a gender-blind minyan. So Rav Yoel ben Nun happens to be, so I'll tell you, this is a great story. I happened to encounter him in person years ago, it's really like 15 years ago after reading this thing from him. And the story went more or less like this. Ran into him and said, I heard that you claim that contemporary women are obligated in time-bound mitzvot. Like, is that correct? He said, yeah, that is. And I said, because I was like, I got to get to the biggest one, you know, someone could be like, oh yeah, women should do all those mitzvot, like for sure. But I wanted to probe whether he was really adopting this category shift, as it were, of like, we live in a different reality. The biblical obligations apply across the board. So I said, so I just want to get it straight. Like, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, with a biblical obligation to hear the shofar, you would say that a woman could fulfill a man's obligation in hearing the shofar? Because that's the test case of like, do you really think things have shifted? And he paused and thought about it for a minute, and he said, yes, I think that's right. And now you got to listen to the different components here. If I were not feeling well and was unable to go to synagogue on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and if my wife knew how to blow the shofar, then yes, I would consider myself to be fulfilled 100% by her blowing it for me to fulfill my obligation. And then he paused for another minute and he said, but she would never agree to do that. Now, that story, I think, is actually funny on a number of levels, like, and sobering on a number of levels. So first of all, just as a lead story, it's like, yes, he does hold that, right? In other words, and that's just an example, and we provide some other stuff in the book, which I plug you buying if you don't already own it. He did not start the Partnership Minyan movement, no. He's been somewhat supportive of that, though. He actually has very conservative views on men and women doing things together. Like, he far prefers a minion of women who do everything on their own, fully, 100%, than getting involved in mixing. That's his particular thing, and we don't have time to do it, but some of the sources here at the end of the sheet go through that. You can see his particular take on that. But, and so on the one hand, you see, yeah, that's what you need to say to get the Levush on board, right? If you're not willing to say contemporary women have the same obligation in shofar as contemporary men, there's just going to be a whole branch of the halachic tree that will not get on board with a gender-blind minyan from that perspective. But this is what you would have to say, could say, and some people have said, and this is my position as well, that there actually is a shift in the whole underlying substratum of obligation, which is pegged on, to use Professor Vered Noam's language, our obligation basically corresponds to the degree of freedom and liberation that we have. The more free a person is, the more obligation they are to use that bandwidth of liberty to serve God. So women and slaves, when they had less bandwidth of liberty in that regard, have fewer obligations. Now when those are lifted, the obligations expand. But the other pieces of the story are also instructive, right? The piece of, well, if I wasn't feeling well and I couldn't go to synagogue, reminds us there are institutions that take up space in the world, in our community, which we're a part of. We don't act just as like free radicals on this whenever we're thinking about, talking about theoretical questions of who counts on a minyan. In practice, it'll often be, well, is there an existing minyan in my community? Am I changing it? Am I starting something new? Like, that's one factor. If my wife knew how to do it, reflects the fact that like there are educational structures or gaps or impediments that you can have all the theories you want in the world. If you don't have the structures that are educating people towards them, that are empowering people towards them, where people know how to daven in a minyan, they know how to lead davening, a lot of the things you've been studying become very quickly highly theoretical. And then the she would never agree to do it piece of it, aside from engaging with, I think, what's often a complicated question of like, what does feminism mean when engaging with actual women and their needs and what they want? And are those the same right across the board? But even beyond that, the notion that you have to bring a community and individuals on board to wanting something. And this discourse looks very different whether you are trying to sort of justify and ground an existing practice as opposed to pioneer a new practice. And the latter is going to require buy-in from people who may or may not be bought in or to different degrees. The last thing I'll just show you here, which hopefully is just helpful, but you have it to review afterwards, is sort of the visual representation of this, right? So the last chart here at the end, I don't know if you use these charts throughout, but just to sort of sum up the minion piece. So on this last page, right, the Talmud does not provide direct, clear, unambiguous evidence on the question of gender and minyan. Again, of the sources we skated over today, the Toldot Yaakov is the best way to kind of see that in action. We then had the medieval positions in minyan. Most don't weigh in at all. They just talk about ten. They don't talk about gender. You have things like Rav Sadia Gaon, we saw him referred to earlier, which is like women don't count. You've got a whole bunch of Provençal sources that say that women do not count and give reasons. You then have a whole bunch of sources of women not counting because of other Rabbeinu Manoach and various components of that source. And then women counting a la Rabbeinu Simcha. The final thing that you see here is what we mostly spent our time on today. What is minyan and what are the ramifications for gender? And here you hopefully can see clearly the two branches, right? Rabbeinu Tam versus the Levush. These are two very different kinds of formulations of what minyan is about. And they require two different kinds of responses or corollaries. For Rabbeinu Tam, if the honor of heaven is not affected, then you're done. Minyan can be gender blind. For the Levush, minyan can only be gender blind if you redefine the relationship of gender to mitzvah more broadly. And that, again, as you've been seeing sort of throughout this material, hopefully lands you in a place which I think is the important place to land, which is, of course, like the practice matters on this. But the point of deeply studying this is to understand what are the underlying values here? What would make sense of divergent practices on this? And how do I hold myself to certain standards of accountability and integrity as I pursue a given halachic path? So to the extent you want to bring the Levush on board, there's a kind of corollary piece of, am I going to educate people? Am I going to educate people in a world in which I'm going to actually teach our daughters to be obligated in all of those mitzvot, to simply quote a thing like Rav Yoel Binun, and not to create religious structures that take men and women equally seriously in terms of religious expectation is not really coherent. In a flip way, Rabbeinu Tam is offering us a pathway of saying there might actually be a way of getting to the minyan conclusion without necessarily having to upend all sorts of expectations about mitzvot. And that might be an important pathway for communities not ready to take that step, but nonetheless wanting to do something practical in this regard.